Well, we have a studio full today. We have a panel. With us is Theron Schmidt, Will Centurion, and Imogen Barker. What we're going to be talking about is the performing arts, the Big Anxiety Festival, and the part that the performing arts plays. I think that we should start, since we've got three people here, talking a little bit about where each of you comes from in terms of your involvement. Theron.
Yeah, so I teach theatre and performance studies at UNSW Sydney, and I come with a background of an interest in autobiographical and collaborative performance making, work that creates encounters with audiences where they can explore kind of deep questions around identity and use the format of performance to perhaps provide new perspectives and new entryways into that conversation. So one of my interests is in contemporary performance practices that maybe break some of the models of typical stage production, but instead move through immersive encounters, one-to-one experiences, site-responsive work. But I'm also interested as a teacher in the ways in which some of the techniques from performance making that have to do with creative expression, with building networks of trust between performers, with finding ways to say what might be difficult. I'm interested in the ways that those artistic methods can be brought out of the artistic context, out of the studio practice, and perhaps even into ordinary classrooms as a way of really bringing people's whole selves to the work that we do as teachers and as learners.
And very appropriate for the Big Anxiety Festival, because one of the themes, as I understand, is to increase empathy. And for the 65% of people who cannot talk about their mental health issues, to help them come forward, to create an environment where they feel more comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I found myself talking about quite a lot in the classrooms recently has been this notion of de-invisibilizing, the ways in which, as critical thinkers, we can start to look at what's been hidden or unspoken in society, which might have to do with structures of power and hierarchies of who gets to speak and who doesn't, given credit and who isn't. But also this concept of de-invisibilizing, I think, really describes the creative practice and certainly describes theater. It's one way of thinking about theater. Theater is making that which doesn't exist have a reality that other people can feel. You know, we're always making something up in theater. It's not really there, but it becomes felt in the room and people have an experience, even though all that's happened has been a conjuring act.
So Imogen, you're currently a theater student. Talk to us a little bit about your background. What's got you here?
I've always been passionate about acting and performing, but I only decided in my final year of high school, about 3 years ago now, that I wanted to pursue acting as a career. So I'm studying a Bachelor of Arts, majoring in theatre and performance at UNSW. And I'm also studying part-time at NIDA because I'm doing the Advanced Actors Studio.
I believe you're quite involved as a leader in some of the student community initiatives.
Yes, I'm on the executive for the second year now of the Student Theatre Society at UNSW, and I'm involved in a number of the productions every year.
And what makes the Big Anxiety Festival particularly resonate for you?
I've had my own struggles with mental health, with depression and anxiety, and I'm always trying to help people be in a place where they're comfortable and able to talk about their emotions, their struggles, or even just their day-to-day life, but in a way that they feel is more receptive to how they're feeling. And I want them to be able to talk in a safe space. And so I try and use my social media as a safe place for people, but I also try and bring that energy into my work and into the places where I am doing acting work.
Will, for many years, you were a performer.
That's
or
right.
Still are a performer, but,
no,
but
not
that was
anymore.
But that was the main focus of your
yeah.
life. And then having got involved in psychology,
mm-hmm.
you are melding those now to very good effect. So talk a little bit about your life and what has brought you sitting there today as an ambassador of the Big Anxiety Festival.
So my background is 20 years as a music theatre performer, predominantly a dancer, but I did act and I did sing as well. So countless musicals, both sort of here in Australia and abroad. Towards the tail end of my career, I started going to university to study applied psychology. I graduated from ACAP with a Bachelor in Counselling Coaching. Now what I've done is I created my own service that offers counselling and coaching for actors, singers, dancers and creative minds, and that offers mental health workshops for theatre workplaces and for training institutions. So it's very sort of industry informed, and it's very much about sort of providing practical solutions to some of the issues that come up for us as performers in terms of mental health.
So your performance history has been in the very traditional meaning of performance, acting in front of very large audiences.
Yep.
Have you seen a lot of mental health issues that made you feel, this is what I need to do?
Not only have I seen, I also experienced. So a lot of what I bring forward or a lot of what I create is about trying to fill the gaps that were quite evident for me when I was a performer in the industry in terms of support. I went through a lot of depression, I went through a lot of performance anxiety, I went through a lot of imposter syndrome. Yeah, I basically discovered that there were quite large gaps in terms of services that were affordable, services that were accessible. It's very much based from a lived experience. Like, I'm actually, to be perfectly honest with you, I'm so nervous right now. It's interesting because this is a very contained environment and there's only four of us. And I'm used to getting up in front of 2,000 people a night and doing eight shows a week. But it's interesting how it affects you at different places. And so right now, my stomach is in knots, my voice is a little bit shaky, and I do feel very, very anxious.
An increasing number of people feel increasingly anxious or stressed in their workplace. But I imagine your workplace, traditionally, you had very specific reasons for anxiety. You had performance anxiety. You had that every time you were going on and displaying your soul, in a sense, to large numbers of people. You had, I don't know, where's the next job going to come from even, which I suppose a lot of people have if they're on contract work.
Yeah. It's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of vulnerability.
Yes. And late hours, wacky sort of hours. You come off stage, there is no way, I imagine, you can then turn around and go to sleep.
Yeah, I've suffered, and I continue to suffer a lot of insomnia.
Okay, back to universities. I think universities would be a place where they feel that they are very supportive of people with mental health issues. But are there problems with the way they go about that support?
Yes, UNSW has placed mental health research and mental health awareness as one of its global strategy goals over the next 10 years. And indeed, the Big Anxiety Festival itself is a manifestation of that. So there's certainly a very strong commitment in a public-facing sense about raising awareness around these issues. But I do think it's quite important that the university also starts to reflect on its own internal structures. And anyone who's been teaching in a university for a while can certainly notice a decreasing trend in student wellness. And this was my experience teaching in London before. It's not particular to UNSW in any way, but the quantity of stresses that are on students learning now are just incredible and nothing like what I had as a student and what many people who set up the structures of university learning experienced.
So what are some of those?
Well, I'm sure Imogen can speak to those more, but I certainly notice people juggling multiple jobs, having perhaps inconsistent housing or lack of reliable housing, as well as an extraordinary pressure to immediately earn income out of university in order to repay the debts that are incurred through study and to make the degree something which therefore is about job readiness rather than about a chance to discover, create, remake, play with oneself. But maybe I'll hand that over to Imogen to speak a little bit.
Yes, Imogen.
I have used the mental health services with UNSW. I agree with Theron in that the university is definitely better than some institutes and some places of study. So university is definitely better than high school in terms of its mental health support. But the services provided aren't sufficient, especially for the number of students that are at that institute. For example, sometimes students will need to see a counsellor or a psychologist, and someone isn't available for maybe 2 to 3 weeks. Sometimes
that's a long time.
That's considered a short time, some institutes. Sometimes you can be waiting a month because there aren't that many counsellors, there aren't that many psychologists, and there's not enough funding going into it to pay for them because it's a free service for the students. Also, if for whatever reason you're not happy or not comfortable with your psychologist and want to change, some services require permission from your original psychologist for you to change psychologist. And getting them to approve that change can be incredibly anxiety-inducing for the students, because then you can start to overthink things and think, oh, well, now they know that I'm not comfortable with them, but it's not because of them personally. Yes. Also, it's incredibly hard getting support for mental health if you haven't had support previously in your life, because you're suddenly having to prove that your mental illness exists and that it's to a degree that affects you and your study, because often the feedback or response, if you list anxiety as an issue, is everyone gets anxious. Anxiety alone affects people in so many different ways, and so it's incredibly frustrating trying to get support in a world that already is sort of against you, in that nobody's talking about this, nobody's aware of how difficult it is to get support in universities and in institutes. But by the same token, at least there is a structure of support there, but it's definitely not sufficient.
What was your experience outside the university environment, say, in a place like NIDA or the college that you attended, Will? So give us a feeling there. Do they have special elective sessions on this subject?
There aren't any sessions, at least in the NIDA courses that I've done and am doing, about mental health or actor well-being. You usually are guided by your tutors or lecturers in those courses, and they say, obviously, take care of yourself, don't push yourself too hard. And NIDA is connected to UNSW's counselling and psychological services. So at the beginning of every course and every term, they say that if any students are having issues, they list the relevant people you can go to in NIDA, so the head of each course, as well as offering that counselling service at UNSW that is also free for NIDA students. However, after that sort of initial, here's what we offer, it's never really brought up again. And if a student is struggling, they're often the one having to make that first step, which is often what is most difficult for people when they are struggling.
I wonder as well, you've spoken about the lack of top-down structures to support mental well-being, but Imogen, you and I had a conversation last week in which you were telling me about your experiences at NIDA, and if you're comfortable doing so, I wonder if you could talk about that experience with the one guest, was it a guest director, who created a very strong community structure, but also a very challenging environment to be in.
Yes, thank you for reminding me. There was one term this year where in the first 3 weeks of our course, our teacher said, you're going to be working together for the rest of the year. It's a class of 9. And she said, you all have to trust each other when you're working together in this place. So in order to do that, each one of you has to sit down for 30 minutes and talk about your life, talk about your struggles, talk about any issues you've had, any family problems, relationships, talk about everything about yourself for that 30 minutes. And then the rest of the class can ask you questions and you pretty much have to answer them. It was extremely exhausting, and every person, when they sat up the front of that class and talked, looked at the floor, even when answering questions. But it was the most beneficial aspect, I think, of any NIDA course I've ever done, because our cohort now implicitly trust each other.
Yes.
We're now comfortable enough with each other, and everything that was said in that room hasn't left that room. And that was the guideline set for that event. And we now are comfortable enough with each other that if someone's struggling, they just say, guys, I'm struggling. I'm not able to come to class today. Or my mental health's been really bad for a few weeks. Or I'm overwhelmed with work. And it's completely natural. And we're all very respectful of each other and what each person is going through.
And the others fill in and back up.
Yes, everyone is very supportive and also makes sure that you are still able to continue with the course, or if it gets to that point, leave the course and you aren't sort of cut off in any way.
And you also spoke about the way that that sense of a resilient community has persisted even though you don't have that director anymore, right? So they were only with you for a short time, but the community carries forward.
Now, Will, what about you and the college? Were you considered a mature student? Were they younger than you?
We were sort of a very, very diverse culture of students. In terms of mental health support, ACAP was great. You know, I used their services several times in order to sort of juggle the academic work and what was going on in my life. So that structure was fabulous and it was very helpful. With regards to theatre workplaces and with regards to performing arts training institutions, that's non-existent. So when I was a performer, there really wasn't anybody on site you could sort of turn to and talk to with regards to your struggles. Interesting in saying that, I don't know if somebody on site is a smart way to go. I think it's something that should be handled off-site, because then there is complete confidentiality and safety around that. And definitely within the schools, I tell you what, the training orthodox at my performing arts school was brutal. And
really?
I wish there had been somebody to talk to about all of that, but there wasn't. And I've probably spent the majority of my adult life working through all those scars.
That is confronting.
Yeah.
Do you think that's because it was another era, if you like? We are more enlightened as far as mental health issues in the workplace are concerned. Is it still the same?
I think it depends on what culture you look at. Some of those performing arts institutions, especially the ones that I've gone into and been able to do mental health workshops at and introduce counselling and coaching services to, are great. You know, they definitely want to come to the table. They definitely want to create change. There are some that are very fixed in their ways. It's very much about sort of suck it up and get on with it. Very much sort of leaning into this myth as a performer that you have to be tortured in order to really love your art and be passionate about your art
and
create good art. There's a lot that has to change. It is happening, baby steps. But the most important thing is, I think a lot of places have to acknowledge that within their culture, vulnerability exists. And a lot of places are terrified to do that, which is laughable because we all know what the issues are. They're very clear. It's just the people on top don't want to accept that they may require external support.
So we've talked quite a bit about how theatre practices can exacerbate mental illness, but the dichotomy is that it can also be a place of healing and build resilience. What do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I mean, Imogen would know as well. It's you, when you have a day where you're completely struggling with your mental health and it's all overwhelming and you need some sort of release, coming into that creative space is therapeutic in some way. It's healing in some way. You get to shed a lot of that emotional weight because you're creating and you're being productive and you're engaged in something else rather than your concerns and your struggles. And so that process is very healing. And you walk away from the other side of a good dance class or a good acting class or a good singing class going, oh my God, I feel so much better. Mm-hmm. So in that, it is quite healing for you. It also builds a lot of resilience because it is challenging at times, both in training institutions and in live performances. And there's no second chances sometimes. You know, you put yourself out there and whatever happens in the moment happens in the moment. And you have to build a certain amount of armor to be able to do that every night. This industry is not for the faint of heart. And so there is some resilience building in that process because you do have to have somewhat of a thick skin, particularly if you want a long-lasting career.
And do you find that you can trust the people you're working with generally when you're in a production, the sort of productions that you've been in?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I've had some amazing casts where we have very much become a tribe and completely stayed in contact with each other. And even now, 10 years after West Side Story, we still catch up, and we were really a beautiful family. And I've had also been a part of casts where it's every man for themselves, and it's a toxic environment, and there's a lot of bullying, and there's no camaraderie, and no one is willing to say to another person, are you okay? And I think that has a lot to do with the way the company is set up. So it's very much a top-down process.
Theron, do you have some comment about that?
Yeah, I do. I'm very much a learner in this area in relationship to mental health and in relationship to building resilience. So these are just my gathering speculations, but I listened to a program called Healing Justice, which is a podcast that deals with people working for social change and also exploring issues of individual and collective healing. And there was an interview with the person named Mark Fairfield, who's worked in social justice and in therapeutic practice. And he spoke about resilience as an anti-individualist practice. And that's really stayed with me because a lot of the emphasis in some versions of mainstream discourse around mental health and resilience has to do with building individual resilience so that I can bounce back on my own and come back and perform, both literally perform in the sense that we're talking about, but also just, you know, perform my job and make whatever the stress or whatever the structural problem is invisible. And I'm much more interested in this collective notion of resilience. And I think that really can apply to the ordinary classroom as well, where students are expected to leave themselves at the door. And it's a model where there's an assumption that everybody's able to just show up and deliver their excellent selves, to be their best self, right? And that's just not true. And that can not only be not an accurate depiction of what's going on for people's lives, I think that structure can actually exacerbate people's sense of isolation and inability to really connect and draw support from others. If we are in competition with each other, then there's very little chance that I'm going to be able to reach out and be there for others, which is why I was really moved and why I wanted Imogen to recount that experience that she had in the rehearsal room as one example of a way in which a anti-individualist, resilient community can be built. I think those emerge quite frequently, spontaneously, or by design within a creative context. And I think we can learn from those spontaneous and deliberate emergences of resilient communities quite a lot that might inform how we shape all other forms of gathering, including the classroom, including the boardroom, you know, including the highest structures of our culture.
So you're talking about creating space for difficult conversations.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. We avoid the difficult, and we avoid it by silencing it.
One of the marvelous things about the Big Anxiety Festival are the awkward conversations. Mm-hmm. And I understand that you're involved in the awkward conversations this year. I don't know whether that's as an ambassador or whether you particularly put your hand up to do that. But tell us what your approach is and what your theme will be, if you like.
Well, when awkward conversations came up, I wanted to definitely participate, and I wanted to create something quite unique. So my suggestion was to incorporate dance and conversation. The concept being that my awkward conversation will be teaching the person that I am partnering the basic steps of the Argentine tango as we talk about anything and everything related to mental health.
The first couple of minutes is an awkward conversation in itself.
It will be awful, and it will mean, I guess, both parties pushing past their comfort zone. You know, that's sort of what life is. And so I think when you are able to relinquish expectation and relinquish control and relinquish shame and fear and judgment, I think you get to the heart of what is potentially something quite beautiful. And so I'm hoping that these awkward conversations will bring to the forefront, you know, a great opportunity to share.
How do you expect to get feedback about this, how people feel, particularly in a case like that where it's very intimate. Very intimate. I imagine when you finish, people will just talk to you about how it went and how they felt. Do you have any expectations of that?
Not at all. I hope I can make people feel comfortable. I hope that people allow themselves to open up and ask whatever they want to ask or share whatever they would like to share. The moment is really whatever you make of it, and what you don't make of it then becomes the missed opportunity. So it's just very much a call to action to just let go and very much live in the moment and see what comes from that.
Yes. What are the things that, I suppose, if you say in the next year, you would like to see accomplished in the area that you're all working in and is doable within a year, Theron and Imogen at the universities?
Well, I'm continuing to learn for myself and to learn through practice. So in some of my classes, which are not necessarily practice-based classes, which are not theater classes, I've been experimenting with shifting around some of the structures of conversation, bringing more embodied experience. Perhaps I might borrow something like teaching each other to dance or something like that into a context before we go on to explore some historical, political, activist movement. Can we begin by checking in with ourselves and what's at stake for us? So it's very, very modest work, but it's one of the exceptional privileges and opportunities of being kind of trusted with a classroom. I'm really starting to appreciate that as quite an honor.
Imogen.
I know that often the top dogs at universities say that there isn't enough money, but if there was recently a review done, and again, this is my own experience at UNSW, there was recently a review done of the mental health services and the division of a lot of the university's funds, as well as the salaries. More money can go into the counselling and psychological services, even if we're just improving that service at first in the next year, because there is such a small number of available counsellors, and even then saying that they're available is a stretch because they are working back to back non-stop for the university, and it's not fair for the students that this service is advertised so readily but is so inaccessible to its students.
Will.
So I guess my biggest aim in the next 12 months, and believe me, I'm working very hard at this, is to stamp the fact that you cannot offer performing arts, you cannot teach performing arts, you cannot ask people to engage in performing arts without some form of psychological support. It's not a choice anymore, it's actually a duty of care, because we put ourselves out there and there is a lot of deconstruction that happens, there's a lot of vulnerability, there's a lot of rehashing trauma in order to create the perfect speech or perfect, and that leaves people very raw. And that is very dangerous. And so my mission is, and what I'm working to do with my mental health service, is to go into performing arts schools and offer mental health workshops, to go into performing arts workplaces and offer mental health workshops, and to offer counselling and coaching specifically for creative minds, because we are a particular breed. And I think I'm lucky enough to know what that language is because I've lived it. And so therefore, I have quite an understanding of what people's stories are and the kind of support that they need in order to be able to create meaningful lives both on and off the stage.
It's wonderful speaking with each of you, Theron, Imogen and Will. Thank you very much for joining us. I've been speaking with Theron Schmidt, Will Centurion and Imogen Barker on how the performing arts can benefit from the big anxiety. We'd love you to come back and listen to other podcasts featuring artists and festival ambassadors in conversation with Beck Dean, curator of the big anxiety, and me, Barbara Sullivan from Radio 2RPH.